Texas flags should also begin each school day with 1 minute of silence. Everyone knew this meant Jesus. My parents told me to sit down quietly after the pledge and skip what teachers called the silent prayer. I decided to boycott the morning ritual altogether. Mid-prayer, Mr. Mack, a photography teacher and Vietnam vet, cracked one eye open, noticing me sitting down, instructed me to stand the hell up. When I shook my head no, he kicked me out and gave me 3 days detention. I was shoving my notebook and Epson Luster paper into my JanSport with a lot of eye-rolling and zero sense of urgency when a linebacker who sat across from me gave us all a civics lesson. "We're a Christian country," he said. "It's called One Nation Under God." By then, I'd grown out of what my sister Stephanie called my giant dork stage, when I wore tortoise-shell glasses and had my head buried in books, Jack Kerouac and Oscar Wilde, years before I really understood them. I even saw myself in Chelsea then. We were about the same age, from neighboring southern states, both avid readers and uncomfortable in our own skin, with smiles full of braces, curls we couldn't control, and frilly dresses with bubbly shoulder pads. I then graduated to my jock stage when I played varsity tennis and was a starting point guard with a reputation for excessive personal fouls. By the time I met Hillary, I was well into my stoner poet stage, during which I maintained an A average while spending most of my junior year in the parking lot of Rome's Pizza, hotboxing Kate's cherry red VW Beetle while reciting Nikki Giovanni poetry. Years later, when I came across Hillary's college letters to a high school friend, I thought of these stages and our shared adolescent misanthropy. "Can you be a misanthrope and still love or enjoy some individuals?" Hillary wrote to John Peevoy when she was a sophomore at Wellesley in 1967. "How about a compassionate misanthrope?" She wrote about the opaque reality of her own self and confessed, "Since Christmas, I've gone through 3.5 metamorphoses and am beginning to feel as though there is a smorgasbord of personalities spread before me, including alienated academic, involved pseudo-hippie, educational and social reformer, and one half of withdrawn simplicity." I didn't care enough about anything to belong to the Young Democrats, if such a thing existed in my public school, I wasn't aware, or the debate team. I didn't pass around petitions to end the death penalty, and didn't have much of an opinion about the news of the day, even though my dad was from Waco and everyone wanted to ask me about the Branch Davidians and if I knew David Koresh. That was outside of Waco, I'd say. I decided, for no other reason than it would piss off every football player who stood around the kegs of Shiner we'd set up in the middle of a field on Saturday nights, that I hated the Cowboys. I didn't eat red meat. I couldn't wait to get the hell out of Texas and move to New York. I loved Bill Clinton, and, worst of all, I loved his wife. I thought things would be different in Austin. I didn't need ivy affixed to a sandstone library, and as my dad reminds me whenever Steph and I bemoan that we never really had a chance to go anywhere besides the University of Texas, it wasn't like Harvard was knocking our door down. But I envisioned something artsy, conversations about Camus over absinthe, maybe. Something more than Dope Bud, a Ben Harper show, and seven of us splitting the same bowl of queso at Magnolia Cafe. I had even more disdain for the sorority girls, the debutantes, than I did the druggies expanding their consciousness, as Hillary summed up both social castes in her college letters. I counted down the days until I could move to New York and become a writer. My closest friend Barry Dale, who theorizes that we'd found each other in middle school and both wanted to move to New York because I was the gay and you were the Jew, had an assignment in his film class. He needed a model to sit in an empty diner in downtown Austin to recreate Edward Hopper's Nighthawks. I wore a tight black tube dress with a deep V-neck from BB, fishnet hose, and a pair of shiny black heels I'd bought a couple of years earlier with my employee discount at the Banana Republic. I sat cross-armed at a bar table as Barry stood on the sidewalk outside snapping photos through the glass. That's the photo I think of from my college years. Not drunken spring break nights or fraternity toga parties, or eating stale pizza on deadline in the basement of the Daily Texan. Me, in an almost deserted diner, wearing black, looking slightly slutty in a mall-bought dress, staring forward and down at nothing and everything. Barry got an A+. I love the feel of the girl, his professor wrote of the photo. It should have been titled the same woe-is-me sign-off that Hillary used to close her college letters. Me, the world's saddest word, she wrote. Chapter 4. Bill Clinton Kaligani. South Africa, 2012. Bill Clinton was holding a glass of Chardonnay but not drinking it the night I walked into his suite at the Saxon Hotel in Johannesburg. It was after midnight. I'd just flown to South Africa in a cramped coach cabin with a team of teenage rugby players who were bursting with testosterone and fist-pumping during the entire 16-hour flight, plus a refueling stop in Senegal. I'd checked into my room in the main house of the Saxon, once the palatial private residence of Du Stein, an eccentric billionaire who befriended Clinton during his presidency. As I walked towards Clinton's private luxury villa, I passed rows of photos of Stein with a younger, plumper Clinton. I crossed a wooden bridge over a pond, the sound of peacocks and fireflies and the hum of cicadas in the distance. I opened the villa's heavy engraved doors. The standalone suite had a private bar and a living room decorated in tasteful neutral hues with a scattering of African sculptures. A handful of friends of Bill, also known as FOBs, sat at a nearby table playing Oh Hell, Clinton's card game of choice. They made small talk about Hillary's 2016 prospects. If Romney wins, the party will have to pave the way for her. Clinton stood by a row of neatly arranged beige leather bar stools, wearing a baby blue V-neck cashmere sweater, tan driving shoes, jeans, and a friendship bracelet tied around his frail wrist. Chelsea sat on a sunken taupe sofa sipping Evian alongside Barry Lurie, her chief of staff. I'd later confessed to one of the donors, Raj Fernando, an algorithmic trader in Chicago, that I felt guilty about how much the Times had paid to send me on the Clinton Foundation trip, a six-night swing through Mozambique, South Africa, Uganda, Rwanda, plus a pit stop in Cyprus so Clinton could deliver a paid speech. Believe me, Raj said, I paid more. It was the summer of 2012, right before Clinton's spellbinding speech renominating Obama at the Democratic National Convention, when no one was paying much attention to Bill Clinton. I'd been in Sun Valley, Idaho, chasing down media moguls and crashing a cocktail party with Wendy Murdoch. Rupert hates the New York Times, but I love you! When Jill Abramson approved the Africa trip. Never mind that it had nothing to do with my beat at the time. Looking back, it's astonishing that the guys ever allowed me to cover this philanthropic swing. We were all so simpatico then that when the Times photographer showed up from a stint in Yemen with no luggage, Clinton loaned him a razor. I was the only reporter who stayed the entire trip, starting with that first night at the Saxon when Bill Clinton talked my ear off well into the early morning hours. Among about a million other topics, he explained that Nelson Mandela had written his memoir on the grounds of the Stein Mansion before it became a five-star hotel. Well, your staying was his home, and that's where I stayed until 2010, Clinton said. He looked around the villa with its high, airy ceilings and spotless marble floors. It's a wonderful place. I love this place, Clinton said. He paused for a moment. He'd visited the Soweto slums earlier that day. The next day we would fly to Rwanda, where we'd take a military helicopter to a red dirt village to visit a children's hospital. Yeah, I always feel slightly guilty staying here, he said. He took a sip of Chardonnay. But I get over it. Over the next 6 days, I vacillated between awe at Clinton's brain power and verve, feeling blessed to be in this brilliant man's presence, and total exhaustion from his self-absorption and driveling on. After a couple of nights of hotel bar banter, I began to feel like the lucky passenger upgraded to first class on a transatlantic flight, only to wind up next to a raconteur who never needs a nap and who rambles on because of some internal hole they need to fill. By the final night in the Kampala Serena Hotel in Uganda, Clinton has relayed his own obscure accomplishments. In Arkansas, we went from 48% to 53% forested land when I left office. He has summed up how to solve Africa's food shortage. We need to do things Americans did literally 80 years ago during the Depression. And he has, for what feels like hours, extolled the virtues of soybeans. You can grow just a thin layer of topsoil. He starts every other sentence with, in the 1990s, and when I was president. The guys even had a name for one defensive monologue I got trapped in after asking about Clinton's decision to invade Somalia in 1993. You got blackhawked, they said. It was after 2 a.m., and all I wanted to do was go to sleep when Clinton told me his advice for how Obama could improve his speechmaking. Suppose we've been friends for 40 years, he said, resting a palm on my shoulder. If you came to visit me in the hospital and said something pretty and eloquent instead of saying, God, I'm sorry, this sucks. I wish I could do more about it. It's an insult. So I told the president the eloquence should always go at the end of his speeches now, never in the middle. I nodded, smiling politely and checking that the red light of my voice recorder was still glowing. He changed outfits at least 3 times a day, usually reappearing in the verdant hotel gardens for dinner with donors, wearing a linen guayabera and khaki cargo pants. Africa chic. He's like Lady Gaga, an aide said. The other thing I noticed about Clinton was how often he talked about dying. He hardly thought he'd live to see the 2016 election, never mind wind up back in the White House. When the manager of a soybean processing plant asked him to come back next year, Clinton said, I'm older than you. We have to make sure I'm still around. When I asked him about Chelsea recently joining the Clinton Foundation board, he said, we're trying to build it up so it'd still run if I dropped dead tomorrow. In Nicosia, we sat down for coffee, and when Cypriots weren't swarming him for photos, I asked whether Hillary would run for president in 2016. She points out that we're not kids anymore and a lot of people want to be president, he responded. I saw things in Africa that made me less cynical about the Clinton Foundation. Under tamarind and mahogany trees, aid workers set up a station where deaf children from the local village could be fitted with their first hearing aids. It's hard to care about whether some sleazy foreign donor wants something from the State Department after you've seen a child hear for the first time. And when the Clinton Foundation is maligned, I think of Bill Clinton Caligani. We were all standing on the tarmac at the Entebbe International Airport, and I'd completely run out of topics to ask Clinton about. I just extended my voice recorder to pick up his stream of consciousness when a military helicopter emerged on the yellow-orange horizon. Is that him? Chelsea said, cupping a hand over her eyes as she looked into the setting sun. Moments later, a slender 14-year-old Ugandan boy in his threadbare school uniform stepped out of the helicopter. His name was Bill Clinton Caligani. His mother had named him after Clinton when he visited Uganda in 1998. A photograph hangs in the Clinton's Chappaqua home. Clinton is holding the newborn as Hillary in a wide-rimmed, out-of-Africa hat looks on. He was born the day before we got there, Clinton told me over the hum of the helicopter. It was one of the most memorable days of my presidency. He walked over and pulled little Bill into his arms. The boy wrapped his hands around one of Clinton's hands and rested his head on that doughy spot on the chest beneath the shoulder. They stayed there like that. After they visited for a while and Clinton said he'd pay the boy's school tuition fees, the staff and donors prepared to board our chartered 737. Aides tugged Clinton towards a separate Gulf Stream, but he wasn't done. He called me over and told me that on that same Africa trip in 1998, a Senegalese farmer had named a goat after him. We're going to fly the goat in next, he said. Chapter 5. Roving. New York City, 2001. 2 weeks after college graduation, I took a one-way flight to New York with no job, no apartment, and a stack of clips from the Daily Texan. I'd saved some bat mitzvah money and what I'd made working in a snow cone stand off Barton Springs Road in Austin. I temped all over Midtown, insurance offices and nonprofits mostly. Before work, I would run around Midtown in my suit and tennis shoes and drop off my stack of clips with the mailroom or security desks at Newsweek, Time, Fortune, etc. A month later, I got a job as a rover at Condé Nast, the publisher of magazines like GQ, Vogue, Vanity Fair, and The New Yorker. Condé Nast rovers were sort of like temps, except that they had 6 months of steady work. We ranked beneath interns who almost all had parents on the Upper East Side and attended a Seven Sisters school, but slightly above the outside temping agency I'd been working for. We had half a year to impress editors and publishers, demonstrating our efficiency at cleaning out closets, changing coffee filters, or picking up dry cleaning. Occasionally, we got to answer a phone. If no one wanted to hire us after 6 months, the gig was up, and the program would be replenished with a new crop of desperate, broke, aspiring magazine writers. We all wanted our chance to temp at The New Yorker and Vanity Fair, but those magazines rarely asked for rovers. Mostly, we helped executives on the terrifying corporate floor, as white and sterile as a hospital, and we rotated in at magazines like Bride, Self, and Allure. One senior editor told me during an interview for a job labeled Beauty Closet Organizer that the best part about working at Allure is that it's like a sorority. Another asked if I would describe myself as a makeup junkie, as if one look at my almost bare face didn't answer that question. Every day at Condé Nast was an education, though not necessarily the one I thought I'd be getting. I was opening mail on the corporate floor for a creative director, a towering, hulking bachelor who wore ascots and had me print out all his emails and then transcribe his scribbles in number 2 pencil in the replies. I got to a package containing a heavy lucite box full of sand and aqua seashells, an invitation to a party in Montauk with the Sex and the City cast. He told me to RSVP no before adding, but do me a favor, find out if that actress who plays Charlotte is single. I asked in the docile voice of domestic help if I could go to the party in his place. How are you going to get to Montauk? Well, I'll take the bus. I had no idea that Montauk sat at the tippy-tip end of Long Island. You're going to take the bus to a Peggy Siegel party, Ascot said. He laughed, more amused than irritated, and walked back into his office with the cream-colored carpet and the 2 white leather bucket chairs that I once heard his assistant describe as the Herman Millers. The furniture had a name, and I didn't. The one time I'd rotated into Vogue, helping to organize the small closet converted into an office and library for the magazine's fact-checkers, I'd worn my brand-new pair of UGG boots. Anna Wintour walked by the closet, paused, and behind her black glasses fixated on the furry brown boots that I'd spent half my paycheck on. I never wore the Uggs again. I'd been crashing at my college boyfriend Russ's place in Bed-Stuy. Back in Austin, Russ and I had bonded over our love of Midnight Cowboy, each of us waxing poetic on its artistic subtleties and our own dreams of moving to New York. I should have known the relationship was doomed, given that this movie, the ultimate testament to big city failure, was what brought us together. Russ had an internship at The Nation that paid a stipend of $150 a week, and he liked to remind me regularly that I worked at lightweight capitalist rags and that he was the serious journalist in the relationship. 15 years later, a Bernie Sanders supporter read my biography online and called me a gruesome cross between Midnight Cowboy and Working Girl. Pretty much. I'm brand spanking new here in this town, and I was hoping to get a look at the Statue of Liberty. My boss at Condé Nast had me come into the office the morning of September 12, 2001. I walked through a nearly deserted Times Square. I tried to remind this editor that no planes were flying, but she was adamant that she'd get to a photo shoot in Paris. On my way to the office, Russ finally called. Other than a brief phone call the day before when we both had to evacuate our Midtown offices, I hadn't heard from him and was starting to worry. He told me he decided to leave New York. He was driving his Honda Civic from its alternate side parking spot in Fort Greene all the way back to the driveway of his mom's house in Tulsa, presumably listening to Dostoevsky on tape. He said he was already in Missouri and had given up on New York. He'd been the only person I really knew in New York, and he'd abandoned me. In that first year, just existing in New York exhausted me. I always got on an express train when I needed a local, watching 15 superfluous stops fly by. I couldn't walk 3 blocks without getting stopped by Greenpeace volunteers or some man with a clipboard who wanted to ask me a question about my hair. Not wanting to be rude, I'd always stop. No, I don't have a perm. No, does it look like I use a deep conditioner? On most nights, I'd collapse, fall asleep fully clothed with the lights on. I'd wake up between the hours of 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. in a pile of saliva, the sound of sirens outside, and the shape of the links from my silver Seiko imprinted on my cheek. 5 months and 3 weeks into my rovership, I got my first full-time job in New York. I would be the editorial assistant to the garden editor at House and Garden magazine. In the interview, garden editor, a fashionably malnourished redhead who wore fishnet stockings and leather skirts and had growled a little when I complimented her leopard blouse, "Careful," she said, "it's a jungle out there." Her husband would leave messages like, "Tell her I'll be home at 6 and we'll need something hot to eat and cold to drink." My duties included running to the flower district on 28th Street each morning, where the sidewalks become an urban jungle of houseplants and cut flowers that supply the city's restaurants and hotels and penthouses. I once got on the Conde Nast elevator hauling cherry blossom branches wrapped in butcher paper when an airy ballerina of a girl about my age strode on, an Hermes Birkin bag slung over her forearm. I only identified this purse and its $10,000 price tag and waiting list because of the week I'd spent in the fact-checking closet at Vogue. "Oh my God, I love your bag. Is it new?" another gazelle of a girl asked. "No," the ballerina replied. "I got it like a week ago." I tried to time my commute so that I could share the elevator with the New Yorker editor, David Remnick. Stalker-like, I craved even the tiniest reminder, the back of a brown head of hair, that my dream was still in my grasp. One time, I stepped off the elevator floor with the purple House and Garden awnings, wearing my usual brown plastic banana clip and thinking about my illustrious future writing gig at the New Yorker. When the doors started to close, I overheard a woman announce to the packed elevator, "Okay, who told her she could wear her hair like that?" Garden editor would disappear for weeks to scout luscious private grounds in England and France and Morocco. She'd come back with a long champ tote stuffed with receipts for me to file and reams of film for me to develop into slides and arrange by theme, Tuscan, Xeriscape, Cape Cod. She'd then present the hundreds of photos, which looked identical to the untrained eye, to the editor-in-chief, who would deem the garden sufficiently tony, or not, to earn a spread in the magazine. One afternoon I was arranging the slides into plastic sleeves, and after 15 images of topiary and a couple bonsai, I landed on photos of the garden editor, sprawled out naked, posing seductively for Mr. Hot to Eat. In retrospect, I could have handled the situation more professionally, but I've never claimed to be a good editorial assistant. My gas must have come out louder than I intended because a crowd of colleagues assembled around my cubicle. They held the slides, now scattered over my desk, up to the light, howling that the garden editor isn't a real redhead after all. It was at that exact moment that editor-in-chief walked by and set her Siberian husky-like eyes on me as if I were some game animal she wanted to mount to the wall of her Pelham colonial. She tried to have me fired for being indiscreet and embarrassing the garden editor. Luckily, the managing editor took pity on me, or anticipated a workplace lawsuit, and talked the editor-in-chief out of it. I needed the paycheck and the health insurance, but part of me wished she'd fired me so I could have filed for unemployment. My roommate at the time had just landed a real writing gig at Variety after being laid off from his job at AOL's movie phone. He'd imitated the languid voice that read the showtimes. "To file for unemployment, press 1. To clear out your cubicle, press 2. I envisioned parlaying unemployment into writing an explosive tell-all in New York Magazine or the New York Observer called The Garden Editor's Bush. I knew my time at House and Garden was up when James Truman, the Conde Nast editorial director who would soon resign to bum around Andalusia and continue his studies with Tibetan Buddhists, flipped through a rough copy of the May issue and instructed editor-in-chief to swap out the cover story for a tiny blurb I wrote on a Chelsea flower shop that stuffed carnations into discarded Café Bustelo cans. This so infuriated editor-in-chief that she sent around a note telling the entire staff, CCing me, that editorial assistants should under no circumstance be allowed to write. I printed out the email and tucked it into my battered copy of A Confederacy of Dunces, which sat on my new IKEA bookshelf, along with 2 volumes of poetry by Elizabeth Bishop and Isaac Babel's complete works, which I'd borrowed from Russ and never given back. The dunces, all in confederacy against me. I took a pay cut to work for a fancy literary agent who wore black leather pants and was on a strict South Beach diet. She'd email me 2 words, protein, run, and off I'd go to buy her hard-boiled eggs or almonds. Every Friday, we had to print out all our email correspondence from the week, and she'd hand the pages back to us on Monday, marked up in red ink where she'd fix typos and stylistic errors. Or in my case, she explained at length why it was inappropriate to ask the agency's clients for career advice. She had a point, but the only reason that I'd wanted the job was because her roster of authors included some of my journalistic heroes. You can do that. I mean, we all do that, but don't ever include it in your correspondence, duh, another assistant in the Park Avenue office told me. She knew about my screw-up because in addition to literary agent editing our emails, her five or so other employees all had to read each other's marked-up correspondence. This led to grammatical shaming in the break room. Can you believe he used passive voice in a message to Knopf? The same assistant said as she showed me how to arrange a hamburger patty on a bed of lettuce as literary agent liked. You'd never think he was a Rhodes Scholar. Just when I was starting to appreciate this semantic sadism as a useful crash course in email writing, literary agent fired me. She thought I'd stolen office supplies, which wasn't technically true. She asked me to order 12 of her preferred purple highlighters, and instead I'd accidentally ordered 12 cases, each of which contained 10 highlighters. Paranoid she'd see this Mount Everest of purple in the tiny supply closet and erupt, I took 10 of the cases home and put them under the bed, figuring I'd gradually restock the office supply with this stash. But as I tried to explain this, literary agent just put up her hand in a please stop talking position. 10 years later, I was still pulling purple highlighters from underneath my bed. I applied for assistant positions at Cosmo, The Economist, The Nation, Redbook, InStyle, House Beautiful, and Martha Stewart Living. I interviewed to be Lloyd Grove's research assistant for his gossip column at the Daily News. I heard he preferred young female assistants. But he took one look at me and could tell I didn't know East Hampton from East Rutherford. I waited and waited, clutching a faux leather pad folio filled with clips from the Daily Texan in the lobby of the old Times building. A political reporter whom my sister met through a mutual friend said she'd meet with me, but she never showed. After an hour, a security guard told me I had to leave. I scrapped around for freelance writing jobs. I reviewed Greek restaurants in Queens and wrote a story for Time Out about things you can buy for a dollar in New York. I worked part-time out of some rich lady's Upper East Side basement, fact-checking a guidebook to interior decorators that she'd published for friends. I applied to Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, even though it would have taken me the rest of my adult life to pay for a single semester. I was waitlisted. I became an early adopter of internet trolling, blasting the whores in corporate media in manifestos that my new boyfriend, the homeless Italian with the camcorder, published on his blog. If you can't join them, troll them. I considered starting a dog walking business. You know it's bad when scooping poop off the sidewalk sounds promising. Finally, in the dead of February, when I was almost broke, I went to the Strand bookstore and bought a lightly used copy of LSAT for Dummies. That same night, over a dinner of yogurt and instant ramen, I got a call from John Bussey, the foreign editor at the Wall Street Journal. Chapter 6, The Foreign Desk. What is this gypsy passion for separation, this readiness to rush off when we've just met? Marina Svetaeva. New York City to Tokyo, Tokyo to Des Moines, 2004 to 2007. The legend went that on September 11th, 2001, after the second plane hit the World Trade Center, across the street, the Journal's newsroom filled with smoke and debris. Security forced everyone to evacuate, concerned that if the Twin Towers collapsed westerly, they would take the Journal with them. John Bussey refused. As reporters and editors fled to safety, Bussey crawled under a desk to report, waded into the street to talk to people, and wrote a story. I reread his lead every September 11th. If there's only one sight I'll remember from the destruction of the World Trade Center, it is the flight of desperation, a headlong leap from the topmost floors by those who chose a different death than choking smoke and flame. 4 months later, Bussey flew to Karachi, where he met Danny Pearl's pregnant wife, Marianne, and tried to negotiate the release of Pearl, the Journal's 38-year-old South Asia bureau chief who'd been kidnapped days earlier. Instead, Bussey ended up having to watch the video of Danny's captors beheading him. Bussy was based in Hong Kong when he called to interview me to be the journal's foreign news assistant based in New York. I don't remember exactly what he said on that first call, but he was manic and fast-talking and unimpressed with my unimpressive resume. My name had only gotten to Bussy because of Blythe. I was a rover filling in as the assistant to Tom Wallace, the editor-in-chief of Condé Nast Traveler, until he found a permanent assistant. I'd of course applied for the job, but a senior editor who looked at my credentials shook her head and said, "Yeah, Tom really wants someone who went to Harvard." I took one look at Blythe's resume, Exeter, Harvard, classical pianist, and decided I hated her. She got the job. 6 months later, we skipped out on some PR luncheon our bosses made us cover to go shopping at Lohmann's. Blythe taught me how to pull an Hermes scarf out of a tangle of marked down DKNY and has been a dear friend ever since. A few months later, she left Traveler to be the journal's foreign news assistant and, in typical Blythe fashion, would, a year later, get promoted and move to Hong Kong. She put me up to replace her. I didn't tell Bussy that I needed the job to save me from pooper scooper or worse, law school. I told him I spoke fluent Spanish, had lived in Mexico, and had spent a year studying Chilean poetry in Santiago. I talked about how I'd written for the Daily Texan and gotten a grant to report from Chiapas on the Zapatista uprising. We got into a heated debate about NAFTA and Pinochet. He'd read my clips, even the blurbs I'd written for Time Out. This led to an in-depth discussion about where to find the best Saganaki in Astoria. I'd left out the part about a prominent literary agent firing me after 4 months. I remember Bussy being intrigued by my impoverished New York conditions. He asked if I had a TV or AC unit. I had neither. 3 weeks and a couple interviews later, Bussy's deputy in New York, Laura Western, called to offer me the position. The second I stepped into the Journal newsroom, nearly 3 years after I'd moved to New York, I felt like I'd finally found my people. It was grimy with low-hung ceilings and reams of printer paper piled up indiscriminately around an open floor plan and pea-green carpet. I arrived at the office every morning before 8. The women wore orthopedic sneakers with skirt suits, and the men all had sweat circles under their pocketed dress shirts. My banana clip fit in just fine there. Bussy being based in Hong Kong meant I had to be prepared for middle-of-the-night requests to overnight a stash of surgical masks when the stores ran out during the SARS epidemic, or to get bulletproof vests for reporters in Beirut, or to find Bussy, a notorious cheapskate, a room in Davos for under $100 that was not a youth hostel. I once had to take dictation from the Latin America correspondent José de Córdoba as he hid in a bathroom in Haiti during the 2004 coup that ousted Jean Bertrand Aristide. I had to get our Middle East correspondents enough cash to buy an armored BMW in Baghdad. To do this, the journal wired $40,000 into my personal checking account, which had about $400 in it at the time. I went to Chase to withdraw the cash. I still don't know if the bank representative was kidding when he asked if I wanted the money in a briefcase, handcuffed to my wrist. I then went across the street to Western Union, and after some odd looks and a lot of paperwork that somehow got me around federal rules for international money transfers, managed to wire the cash to Iraq. I'm certain this errand landed me on a terrorist watch list. But mostly Bussy and Marcus Broccoli, the national news editor, and other senior journal editors encouraged me to blow off my assistant duties. "You want to be a writer, you have to write," Bussy said. Marcus once saw me struggling over a pile of newsroom expenses to process and staged an intervention. He picked up a handful of receipts from various countries. The currency conversions alone were making my head spin. By then, I'd written several features, including one about people who impersonate Navy SEALs, and helped with 2004 campaign coverage. But I hadn't yet cracked the front page. "You are not allowed to file a single expense report until I see your byline on page one," Marcus said. "That's an order." He approved a 6-night reporting trip to Iceland so I could write a feature story that ran on the cover of the media and marketing section. I wrote half a dozen A-heads, the journal's term for the quirky middle column that runs daily on the front page. One was about women undergoing surgery to reconstruct their hymens so they appear to be virgins again, a story I'd come across while browsing the ads in the back of Oi, the Spanish-language newspaper. I took the F train to Queens to meet Esmeralda Vanegas at Hymen Ridgewood Surgery. "It's the ultimate gift for the man who has everything," one of her patients told me. An editor proposed the headline, One Night Strand. We went with Virgin Territory. And I wrote a couple leaders, journal parlance, for the serious economic or business stories that run in two columns on the front page. I also left a delegation of Brazilian diplomats waiting in the lobby so I could finish an interview. I was on deadline and forgot to order coffee in Danish for a meeting with top editors and a dozen Alibaba executives visiting from Hangzhou. I had about 200,000 rupee worth of expenses piled up that I needed to process. I'd screwed up the conversion and thought this was about $150, but turned out to be more like $3,000. I killed it at being a bad assistant. Bureau chiefs who work for Bussy used to warn me that I should always check for my wallet when I left his office. I didn't know what they meant until he offered me a job as a foreign correspondent based in Tokyo. After our talk, I felt like a rock star, the euphoria lasting about 4 minutes until the practicalities of this position set in. I didn't speak Japanese. The little I knew about Japan I picked up from a couple Murakami novels and a 5-day vacation in Tokyo to visit my friend Aika, a man-eating DJ whom I'd backpacked around South America with in college. I could hardly afford to live in New York on my salary, let alone Tokyo. But I was cheap. The journal gave me a salary raise to $40,000 a year and called it a suitcase relocation. I had no family or house full of belongings to relocate. I could pick up in the same red suitcase I'd used when I first moved to New York. My mom cried when I told her. "No, no, I'm really happy for you," she said through sobbing so loud I had to hold the phone away from my ear. "But Japan?" A couple of weeks before my big move, Ellen Byron, who covered retail at the Journal, urged me to go out with her on St. Patrick's Day. "Come on, you'll meet an Irish guy," she said. She knew that my fling with an Iraq correspondent who called me Habibiti and had a fiancé in Washington had imploded. I don't know if I even liked him that much, but I'd been so impressed with his career and his dispatches from war zones that I became infatuated. I confided this to one of my bosses, a page one editor who shook her head of short gray curls. "Amy," she said, "you can't fuck the copy." I agreed to go for one drink, as long as I didn't have to wear green or talk to anyone wearing a Kiss Me, I'm Irish t-shirt. There in the Pig and Whistle, the type of generic Times Square pub I would never normally go to, I saw Bobby. He was brooding against the bar, a trio of blondes forming a half circle around him. He wore a khaki trench coat and had the gentlest hazel eyes framed by sad, expressive lines. With a head of thick black hair, he stood a good foot taller than the blondes. He drank a freshly poured pint of Guinness, licking his upper lip to remove the frothy white mustache that formed after each sip. I tugged at Ellen's arm, subtly pointed his way, and said, "See that guy right there? He's my new Irish boyfriend." "He was a friend of a friend," Ellen said, and introduced us. Bobby told me he was from a town called Trim, about 45 minutes outside Dublin. "Isn't the whole country 45 minutes outside Dublin?" God, I was awful at this. But he seemed amused. We all left the bar to see a U2 cover band called Unforgettable Fire. Bobby bet me $5 that the final song would be Where the Streets Have No Name. I agreed, not knowing that he'd already looked up the set list. When the concert ended and everyone spilled out onto the sidewalk, I handed Bobby a $5 bill. He wrapped my navy peacoat around my shoulders and flagged me a taxi. He was drunk and his upper lip quivered. We hugged goodbye. I'd just met him, yet I had the strangest feeling of my feet elevating off the sidewalk, or maybe it was the sidewalk that had sunk beneath us. Either way, I looked up at him disoriented, feeling punched in the gut, that place where the heart is. "Chosik Bussy," the voice said before I could say hello. He always ran the words together into one Slavic Norman surname, Chosik Bussy. "How'd you like to go to Iowa to cover Hillary Clinton?" It was 2007, and Rupert Murdoch had just paid $5 billion for the Journal's parent company, Dow Jones. Management, unsure what the takeover would mean for the paper's political coverage, needed to install a loyal Journal lifer as Washington bureau chief. And there was no one more loyal than Bussy. Within days, he'd left the Journal's Hong Kong bureau overlooking Victoria Harbor to move to a dreary office building off K Street. There were no niceties with Bussy, no explanation of what the job would entail or what I'd be paid. the same salary I'd made when I left Japan, $43,000 a year. I'd only moved back to New York from Tokyo a couple weeks earlier, a squishy brown capybara-san charm, a plush version of the world's largest rodent, still hung from my cell phone, one of the many accessories that seemed appropriate for a 27-year-old foreign correspondent in Tokyo, but that I should have retired to a landfill when I got back to the States. Bobby and I had done long distance for nearly 2 years. We'd lose entire days, or nights, depending on who was in which time zone, talking via a scratchy Skype connection. I'd stay in the journal's bureau late enough to call and wake him up for work each morning, and he'd do the same when the sun set in New York. I had a Miffy calendar on my desk and would mark off the floppy, bunny-eared days until his next visit to Japan or my next trip to the States. I hadn't intended to do long distance with the Irish guy I'd picked up in a bar on St. Patrick's Day weeks before my scheduled suitcase relocation to Japan. I also had a rule about not dating guys who worked in finance, but Bobby was more math geek than Wall Street Wolf. We shared the same gypsy spirit, and even when we lay in bed my last night in New York and I confided how terrified I was to move to Tokyo, to leave everything familiar, Bobby only held me tighter, told me that I had to do it, and that he'd come visit. We fell in love in Japan. Without Bobby, Tokyo was soul-crushingly lonely. With him, we laughed ourselves silly walking through Yayoi Park. We gawked at the girls in their bo-peep dresses and the grown men swing dancing, their hair in exaggerated slick-back pompadours. We practically bankrupted our favorite all-you-can-eat shabu-shabu joint in Shibuya, and soaked in Japanese hot springs so long our skin shriveled. Bobby's cotton yukata hitting knee-length on his sinewy 6'1 frame. "I think we should shack up when you get back to New York," he said one night. On his last visit to Japan, I watched him descend the elevator at Narita Airport in the ratty sweater that he'd had since his University College Dublin days. I pressed my hand against the glass partition, trying to touch him and watching him disappear into the foreigner's immigration line. I turned to walk back to the Narita Express, as I always did, but instead collapsed, crying outside the duty-free mall. This led to two police officers asking if I was okay. "Genki desu ka?" The Japanese don't do public displays of emotion, especially not that close to the Louis Vuitton. I had to get back to New York. 6 weeks later, Bobby moved his meager belongings into the yellow-walled, rent-stabilized East Village apartment that I'd sublet while I was in Japan. The apartment overlooked a courtyard and a Hare Krishna temple with its cloud of patchouli that made our hallway smell like a hippie's armpit. Randy Jones, the cowboy from the Village People, lived upstairs and transformed the hot tar of the rooftop into an illegal garden with vines of plump tomatoes climbing up a cinder block canopy. We were finally nesting. Bobby's office wasn't far from the journal's newsroom. He stood next to me on the sidewalk in Lower Manhattan when Bussy's call came in. It was October, but warm. We had planned to walk home after work together, maybe getting dinner in Little Italy on the way, the kind of low-key evening activity that normal couples do all the time, but that we'd fantasized about in so many long-distance calls. He saw my face and mouthed, "What?" rolling his eyes in anticipation. I didn't have time to explain. Bussy's tone sounded panicked, like the time he'd tried to stop Blythe and me from going to Vietnam in the middle of the bird flu epidemic. He'd framed the idea, "How'd you like to go to Iowa to cover Hillary Clinton?" as a question. But there was only one answer. When do I leave? Chapter 7. Scoops of Ideas. A zealot cannot be a good cultural anthropologist. Ruth Benedict, The Chrysanthemum and the Sword. Des Moines, 2007. Unlike most campaign reporters who descended on Des Moines each presidential cycle and for all the steak fries and state fairs in between, I'd spent the prior couple of years covering Japan's consumer culture. I wrote a front-page story about how westernized diets were causing young Japanese women to have larger breasts, headline, "Developing Nation." In 2007, as my competitors were meeting campaign sources at Chentro, Des Moines' hottest restaurant, though there wasn't a lot of competition, I was clubbing in Shinjuku with Kinsan, a Japanese DJ friend who went by the stage name Intelligent Milli Vanilli, a phonetic challenge for the Japanese. I didn't know who ran John Kerry's 2004 campaign. I'd never heard of Politico or its playbook. The name Barack Obama sounded only vaguely familiar. When Bussy asked me to go to Iowa, I thought for sure I'd be riding the Hillary Clinton beat all the way to the White House. Years later, I confessed to one of the guys that when I got to Iowa, I didn't know what a caucus was. "Don't worry about it," one of them said. "We didn't know what a caucus was either." I thought it would be a relief to report in English again, but I still didn't entirely speak the same language as the people I was covering, especially Mark Penn. Penn was Hillary's trusted pollster who, after her third-place finish in the Iowa caucuses, went from being the brains behind the former First Lady's political ascent to the asshole responsible for everything bad about the 2008 campaign. Poor bastard couldn't even blame the Russians. Mark had some terrible ideas, like his early reminder before the 2008 campaign that being human is overrated. But he always saw Bill's base of white working-class men as a central part of Hillary's victory, and he turned out to be correct that most voters didn't want to elect the First Mama. On the flight from Des Moines to Manchester after Hillary came in third place behind Obama and John Edwards, Penn pushed his comb-over sweep of coarse brown hair over his sweaty forehead and told us, "We're in a strong position to move forward." I whispered to Ann Cornblut of the Washington Post, who sat in the bucket seat next to me and pounded so hard on her laptop that her tray table vibrated, "Is that really how they talk?" Ann smiled at me as if I were a yapping lapdog that she wanted to silence. She went back to transcribing Penn's comments. One time in Japan, during an interview with a high-level executive, I asked my interpreter, Ayako-san, to grill him on a question I knew he was evading. She cautioned, "Amy-san, it is extremely rude to ask the same question twice." I was always inadvertently being rude in Japan, so I told her to go ahead. The executive's eyes bulged. He leaned in close, his breath smelling of cigarettes and ponzu sauce. "Amy-san, I have already answered that question," he said in clear but heavily accented English. "My answer is neither yes nor no." I remembered that exchange when I first started covering American politics, and whenever we pressed Hillary and her top aides, I imagined them all morphing into anime versions of themselves, with tiny bodies and round bulbous heads, a floating thought bubble on top. "We're in a strong position to move forward. My answer is neither yes nor no." Everything seemed like a story to me in 2008. I wrote a feature about campaign hookups, a topic so baked into the process that no one thought Secret Service guys, motto wheels up, rings off, ducking into reporters' hotel rooms was news. I even convinced one of the guys to talk on the record about hookups. When everyone gushed about how nice Iowans were, I caught up with a Des Moines alt-rock band that had gained local fame for venting about the out-of-state media and political elites in a musical number called "Get Outta Our Town, Caucus Lament." The chorus went, "Get outta our town, get outta my face, you barged into our home with your political race." By the time Obama was sworn in 2009, the Murdoch regime had started to exert its influence at the Wall Street Journal. The new ownership, judging our feature stories as having the gestation of a llama, or about 350 days, infused the newsroom with a new metabolism for breaking news. But during the campaign, my editors still urged me to look for what they called scoops of ideas, the offbeat feature stories that nobody else covered. I didn't realize how pretentious this sounded until I tried to explain the idea to a Politico reporter who could barely look away from his BlackBerry for the 20 seconds it took to reach into the innards of the campaign bus and pull out our luggage for the night. "Did you even file anything today?" he asked me as he fished out his roller bag. "No, my editors don't really want daily stories," I explained. My inner voice nudged me, "Don't say scoops of ideas." But I didn't listen. They want scoops of ideas, you know, like rather than writing "this happened today" or getting something from the campaign that's inevitably going to get out anyway, finding a totally different angle that no one else thought of. "Uh-huh, you go ahead with your scoops of ideas and I'll be over here breaking news," he said. What I didn't tell him was that scoops of ideas were my only option. I hadn't yet developed the killer instinct to compete for news, and my editors didn't seem to care when the Times' Pat Healy or Politico's Ben Smith scooped me. Not that I could have competed. I hardly had any sources. Unlike my competitors, most of whom had come up covering New York politics or Congress, no one had heard of my byline or me. Nor did Bussey's installing me on the Hillary beat sit well with some of the paper's more seasoned political reporters. By the time I'd switched to the Obama bus in the spring, my counterpart on the McCain campaign staged an intervention. She pulled me aside outside the Journal's workplace at the Democratic National Convention in Denver. We'd previously teamed up on covering a debate during which she reamed me out for not grasping the nuances between Obama's and Hillary's healthcare proposals. Her plan is a mandate. Repeat slowly after me. Mandate. We'd been paired up again, this time to write the front page story about Hillary's speech that night, in which she would ask her delegates to unite behind Obama. Like Hillary, my co-author felt the need to extend a strained show of unity to a less experienced colleague. "Look, I wanted to say I'm sorry. I know I've been really mean to you," she said, blinking rapidly behind the foggy lenses of her glasses as we stood in the August heat against a chain-link fence adjacent to the Pepsi Center's parking lot. "It's just that I really don't think you're qualified to be doing this job." The only person on the Hillary campaign I really got to know was Jamie, the dutiful press wrangler who remained catatonically upbeat even after 4 hours on a bus with reporters asking her nonstop questions about when we'd get lunch and whether we'd get our Marriott points. "Jamie, can you pass the granola bars back here? Not those, the peanut butter ones. And Jamie, I think I left my power cord in Sioux City. And Jamie, how long till we get there?" She was so smiley and obedient that behind her back the guys called her the Golden Retriever. Jamie led us into my first Hillary town hall held in the Shenandoah Fire Station. Tom Petty's American Girl blasted from the speakers. I soaked up the Americana. There were homemade pies set up on folding tables against corrugated metal walls and red fire trucks and old men in patch-covered garrison caps. Their wives wore Christmas sweaters with puffy paint Rudolphs and tiny flickering Christmas lights. Hillary appeared at the front of the room, and before she even said anything, I stood up from my seat and clapped. That's when I felt Jason George of the Chicago Tribune tugging at the right side of my parka. "Dude! Dude!" I just met Jason that day, but he had the concerned expression of an old friend saving me from swallowing a handful of sedatives. "What the hell are you doing? You can't do that." I looked at the rest of the press, all staring stone-faced at their laptops, too focused on their screens to notice my faux pas. I quickly sat back down in my chair. Chapter 8. Taking Back America. Iowa, 2007. Writing for the Wall Street Journal with the nation on the cusp of the 2008 financial crisis came with some built-in advantages. Although I still dressed like a Japanese teenager, meaning I wore everything in my closet all at once, jeans, under dresses, under blazers, over cardigans, until I was one chubby gaijin layer, Hillary and those on her campaign staff assumed I was policy-minded and serious. Even other reporters would frequently turn to me and ask what Hillary meant after she'd shout at rallies, "Mortgage-backed securities and subprime lending." All of this despite the fact that I couldn't tell you what equity derivatives were. "No one knows what derivatives are, that's the whole point," the Journal's finance editor once assured me. The candidates actually wanted to do interviews with me. I got a 45-minute sit-down with Hillary, my longest ever. She predicted the housing crisis, warned that the U.S. could slip into a Japanese-style malaise, something I knew about, and criticized NAFTA, the trade deal her husband signed into law in 1993 that would dog her through both of her presidential campaigns. There have been some positive results of trade, but there is still too much of the benefits of trade and global capital markets favoring elites and multinational companies in a way that is not spreading prosperity, she told me and my Journal colleague, the economics writer Bob Davis. Bob and Hillary knew what derivatives were. A couple of weeks before the caucuses, the Journal's politics editor, Jake Schlesinger, called. "Edwards wants to sit down for an in-depth interview about the economy after his rally today. Can you get to Vinton by 2 p.m.?" Jake asked. I hesitated. I'd been in Iowa long enough to know Vinton was in the Cedar Rapids metropolitan area, if you could call 255,000 people a metro area. A 2-hour drive from Des Moines on a good day. But on that day, a blizzard had parked over the state, making driving conditions perilous for locals and a particular death trap for a transplant New Yorker driving a rented Hyundai Elantra with no snow tires. This would be exclusive. He asked specifically for the journal, Jake said, in a tone that was neither pushy nor impolite, but that told me I didn't have a choice. Leaving now, I said, and started to pull on my army green parka and snow boots. The Edwards campaign was in crisis mode after the National Enquirer's John Edwards Love Child scandal story broke. We'd all been too polite to follow the story, maybe because Edwards' wife Elizabeth had cancer or because we all thought ourselves above chasing the Enquirer, or both. Still, for Hillary, there exists an alternate route in the Rube Goldberg of why she will never become the FWP. The media runs with the Edwards baby daddy scandal, causing him to drop out before the caucuses, allowing Hillary to pick up enough of his supporters to win Iowa, halting Obama's momentum before it started, and allowing her to win the nomination and defeat John McCain. Trucks skidded off the interstate. I could hardly see the road and felt my tires floating on a layer of ice and snow. By the time I arrived in the cafeteria of Vinton High, Edwards was finishing his tirade against the growing divide between the haves and have-nots. I wouldn't appreciate Edwards' two Americas and his populist pitch decrying inequality and global trade until 2016, when Bernie and Trump used an almost identical playbook. Edwards ended up an imperfect messenger, a slick millionaire trial lawyer with a love child. We know, you're the son of a mill worker. But he was ahead of his time. I found an empty seat next to the New York Times' Julie Bosman. Julie was the paper's Edwards beat reporter until, as a Times editor liked to say, her horse didn't just die, he got caught fucking Secretariat. Edwards concluded his Vinton speech by pointing to our thinly populated press area. You see all those reporters in the back, he said in a gesture that felt like a game show host breaking the fourth wall. A scattering of heads turned around. I met eyes with an older man in denim overalls and a purple and gold Say You button. They'll be ratting he said, she said, while we're taking back America. He was even ahead of his time in shaming the elite media. I approached Edwards backstage, as his press secretary had instructed, and extended my hand to shake his. Hi, Senator, I'm... Edwards glanced briefly at me and kept walking. Just a second, honey, he said, flashing a palm at me in a halting motion. I got an interview with the Wall Street Journal. I am the Wall Street Journal, I said. Chapter 9, Leave Hillary Alone, Washington, D.C., 2014. I knew Hillary was running again on a Monday afternoon in early May. She'd sent all the guys, including outsider guy who avoided D.C. and had to fly cross-country, to attend the meeting, along with her closest aides. These included Cheryl Mills, the classy, elusive lawyer who'd defended the Clintons during impeachment and Benghazi and who knew how to drape a scarf in even the hottest State Department convoys to Senegal. Tina Flournoy, a former union leader and boxing aficionado from Georgia whose combination of tenacity and southern charm made her uniquely qualified to hold the unenviable role of Bill Clinton's chief of staff. And Huma Abedin, the elegant waif and tabloid fixture who'd worked for Hillary since she was a 19-year-old White House intern and George Washington University student. Ever since I arrived in Iowa in 2007, I'd marveled at Huma the way women tend to marvel at impossibly thin, fashionable women. She was the only one, including Hillary, who didn't gain at least 10 pounds in 2008. It got so bad that by the Indiana primary, I saw Chelsea swat her mother's hand away. Mom! From a deep dish of chips and salsa. And I watched, hardly able to keep up in my bulky snow boots, as Huma glided alongside Hillary in stilettos during the Scranton St. Patrick's Day parade. The press speculated about whether Huma had hooked up with one of the guys who had a fiancé in New York, our very own soap opera unfolding on the plane. But on one flight toward the end of the primary, Huma introduced the 08 traveling press to her new boyfriend, a promising young congressman from New York named Anthony Weiner. It had been just over a year since Hillary had stepped down as Secretary of State, and now certain that Carolyn Ryan had a personal vendetta against her family, she had instructed her most trusted loyalist to convene at the New York Times Washington Bureau and express her concerns about my coverage. Why would Hillary do that if she wasn't running? When the guys emailed a list of the 7 aides who planned to attend the meeting, Carolyn wrote back, "We're gonna need a bigger boat." We all agreed the discussion would be off the record, but it didn't take long for somebody to tip off the conservative Washington Free Beacon, which soon after published a story with the headline, "Hillary to New York Times, back off." But the Beacon